Welcome to the REI Mastermind Network, where host Jack Haas gathers amazing stories from leaders in real estate investing. In each episode, our guests will tell you what they're doing that works, what they've tried that failed, and best of all, you'll learn actionable steps to take your real estate investing to the next level. Now, here's Jack with another value-packed episode.
We have Grant Pruitt with me here today, and you can learn what he is up to by heading over to whiteboxrealestate.com. And if you stay towards the middle of the episode here, he's even going to give you out further contact information, maybe an email address and phone number. But again, it is whiteboxrealestate.com. We're going to be talking about commercial real estate with a bit of a twist because Grant has a ton of experience. In fact, his value now, and it's probably out of date here, Grant, so you can give us this updated number, over $800 million in value right now in the portfolio, 8 million square feet of real estate transactions. Is there any updates to those numbers?
Yeah, it's certainly grown since that. By what scope, I couldn't tell you. You hope it always continues to grow. If we do this in 10 years, it'll be even more.
But we're going to be talking commercial real estate is office, industrial, and data center brokerage. And we haven't talked a lot about this. So this is a bit of a new topic. We might nerd out on a couple things. So really appreciate your time, Grant.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You've got a lot of experience, especially going into White Box. Could you talk a little bit of, it seems like real estate investing is a bit of an accidental occupation. Can you tell us how you managed your way into this niche?
You know, I'm not sure on the commercial space if it's as accidental. It has to be pretty intentional on the commercial space, primarily because of the capital that's involved with that. You know, it's a great way to buy what I think are stable assets that cash flow and you really create a great return on investment. But you really have to be diligent about what you're doing there. I think that's the nuance there.
You know, you mentioned stable assets. Is that even after with the COVID and everything that happened over the past few years? Have you seen any change in your market?
To be completely candid, I think right now is a really great buying opportunity. Anybody that I've worked with in the past, any of my clients personally, if you're not looking for stuff, now is the time to be looking at it and be looking at buying it, dependent upon where it is and what the market is. You know, when the market's really good, everybody wants in, and it's really, really expensive and it's really difficult and you have to be very, very fast. When the market softens, it's a lot more difficult for people to contemplate buying, but it creates incredible buy opportunities that create really great long-term value. Because at the end of the day, you know, the three most important things about real estate are location, location, location. And if you're buying the good locations, they may not decline as much as some of the others, but you're going to see some sort of a softening, some sort of decline because the demand just isn't there. And so I would say that with most of the groups that we work with, we're very actively contemplating what those acquisitions look like.
So could you talk a little bit about what you mean regarding the commercial space, especially industrial? What type of tenants are you usually attracting to these locations?
So, you know, I'll just limit it for this conversation to Dallas-Fort Worth because, you know, every market's going to be different. But some of it's going to be product type specific. Some of it's going to be sub-market specific because, you know, some of them are going to be a little bit more of a showroom type feel. You don't need the clear heights. You know, you can get away with 12, 14, 16, 18 foot clear heights. Don't have to worry as much about the loading. Maybe you don't need to be able to get a 53 foot trailer in there. And those can be excellent. You can also command a little bit higher price point on the rents with those, typically because of what they are, because of the use that they are. You know, then you get to, and they're typically going to be a little bit older facilities that are maybe a little bit more centrally located than some of the others. Then you're going to get to, you know, your 1980s, 1990s vintage buildings that are going to be 20, 22, getting up to 24 foot clear heights. And that's going to attract a totally different tenant base. It's going to be less showroom, less artistic, less office intensive. It's going to be typically more in the range of, a lot of them end up being things that, you know, are home wholesalers. You know, that's why you find them near rooftops. So it's going to be a plumbing wholesaler, flooring wholesaler, HVAC wholesaler, anybody that's selling stuff for the home business, and anybody that's in the e-commerce side, because they're both looking for rooftops there. They're looking for speed to those particular locations. And then you get to a little bit bigger box, and that's where you start getting into different kind of institutional style uses, you know, still e-commerce, but on a much larger scale, you know, and so forth. So it's gonna vary. The credit profiles are going to also vary very widely over those as well. But, you know, that's kind of the broad answer, if you will, as to what that looks like.
Sure. It sounds like a lot of the companies that you're working with are quite a bit larger, probably scaling. And would you say that they're going to be a bit more stable in that regard?
You know, we work with companies of all different shapes and sizes. You know, I've done work with true startups that are, you know, this is their first foray. You know, they just got some sort of seed funding, something like that, all the way up to, you know, $18 billion publicly traded corporations and everything in between. You know, I wouldn't say that there's one particular niche. You know, you get maybe a little bit in certain niches versus others, but it's really, you know, they're all across the board. And, you know, there's a fit for every tenant that's out there. You know, it's kind of like clothes. You know, there's a shoe or there's a jacket or something for everybody that's out there. It's just making sure you find the right size, the right price point, et cetera.
During the whole pandemic situation, did you find a pretty significant shift during that time as you were, I would imagine, you know, being in IT to a certain extent, there's a big shift in supporting these workers that were working from home. And did you find that your data center side of the business was growing more rapidly, or how did that bit look?
The data center side has changed so much in that the players have changed, the utilizations have changed, the adoption of cloud has changed, the idea of what a secure cloud is has changed. And so, you know, I think that just accelerated a trend that was already coming down the pipe and was going to come to fruition one way or another. That was going to come one way or another. I think the biggest shifts really were on the industrial side and the office side, in my personal opinion. You know, the industrial side was a roller coaster. People always think about the industrial side doing exceptionally well, but there was a 4-month period or at least a 3-month period where people literally had no idea what was going to happen. You know, if you take yourself back in time, there was a time when literally everything in the world shut down, everything. And you really, you know, it's as simple as you didn't really know if you were going to live to see tomorrow at one point in time. That's really what it came down to. And that everything went south at that point. You know, there were unbelievable buying opportunities at that point in time because of what it was, but nobody really knew if it was going to matter. And so there was just so much distraction. And then you got through that 3-4 month span. That's when you started seeing that ramp up. And that's where you saw the explosion and the acceleration of what the three biggest drivers had been. And really, to an extent, two of them continue to be moving forward. The biggest driver being e-commerce, which when we started, it was 13 to 15% of our retail sales, and you know, we're at somewhere between 18 and 21% now as it relates to retail sales being e-commerce related. And you know, the thing is, people had to have somewhere to warehouse that. Somebody had to have somewhere to store that product. So e-commerce was a driver, continues to be a driver for industrial demand and industrial space. We saw a huge disruption in shipping and transportation and manufacturing overseas, where you know, you had factories in China that would just be shut down, and all the workers would go home and they wouldn't be able to produce the product. And so we had already started to see some onshoring of manufacturing that accelerated and really multiplied the onshoring of manufacturing. And we're still seeing that onshoring of manufacturing that's coming down the pipe. It's really the increased inventory levels piece that we see much less of that went through the system. And I call it the toilet paper effect, because, you know, if you remember, we ran out of toilet paper. And if you look at toilet paper demand had been constant for, you know, with marginal increases relative to population increases, really for the last 50 years. And all of a sudden somebody decided that they wanted to buy more toilet paper than the next person, and everybody went out and bought more toilet paper. And the increased inventory levels weren't there to be able to accommodate that demand. And so we were seeing roughly 30% increased inventory levels to try and mitigate and stop these spikes on things like toilet paper, Lysol, hand sanitizer. And it really trickled all the way down to all the different things. Because if you think about it, when it disrupted manufacturing, it was clunky, and we're still paying for it. We still have that clunkiness that we, you know, what is this, 3.5, almost 4 years later, we haven't quite gotten back to where we were. And that, you know, you shut a factory down that made, you know, this widget. And then when it came back online, it was more important that we made a different widget. So we put that off on hold, and then this one shut down. And so, you know, the clunkiness of getting back into the regular flow is still not quite there. The shipping continues to be an issue. And so that's it took it from an industrial market that was not doing well to an industrial market that nobody had ever seen. And quite frankly, I don't know if I'll ever see that kind of demand ever again. And now we're seeing a normalization of what the industrial demand looks like and what the industrial markets look like. And it's interesting because you hear people talk about how it's not good and it's not doing well. And that's really just not the case. It's on par with where we were pre-COVID, probably in the better years, statistically speaking. And if you're going to look at industrial as an asset class, that's the one that I think that, you know, 12, 18 months down the road, you're going to see a huge spike again, just because we're not building the product that we'd been building to keep up with the demand. The demand is not quite what it was, but it's still relatively constant, but they can't get the financing. And so there is going to be an increase in demand, which will put upward pressure on rents, will put upward pressure on price per square foot, and will put downward pressure on cap rates. So, you know, that's been interesting. The office market, that's the one that I think is, I don't know when or if we're ever going to be back to where we were. I love to have that conversation with people, just because everybody wants to talk about what they read in the newspapers, and I quit reading the newspapers. The only reason I read the newspapers is because I know that they're going to ask me about it. You know, yet you have Class A product in Class A markets, and just about everywhere across the country, it's less than 10% vacancy, and they're continuing to see increases in rental rates and appreciation value there. You look at the Class B assets, they're incredibly vacant. You know, if they're 20% lease, they probably should only be 5% lease or 10% lease. And that's a huge issue that I'm not sure how it's going to be rectified or what you're going to do with that. And then the overarching theme with all of these is that capital markets piece that is really making it difficult to price deals, and it's driven a lot of people out of the market, but it's also the reason that I see so much opportunity. And I'll give you a great example of what I'm talking about as it relates to that. So when the Federal Reserve started raising rates, I mean, that to my knowledge, that is the fastest in modern time that they ever raised rates. And it made it really difficult with lending institutions because, you know, there's a risk premium for lending institutions that got passed back to the consumer because they had no idea how quickly rates were going to go up and if they were going to miss the mark pricing these deals. And so it drove everyone out. They wanted more securitization. So you saw loan to value ratios go up. So they wanted more equity, or excuse me, come down. They wanted more equity in the deals than what they had. You saw cap rates go up. You saw you saw cap rates go up as a result of lack of demand. You saw interest rates go up with risk premiums tied on top of that. And now what we're seeing in hindsight is the challenge of getting these deals refinanced, because let's say that it was, 40% equity in the deal. Now they want 50, 60%, and they're looking for, they got it financed on a 4, 4.5% interest rate. And now they want a, 8.5, 9% interest rate. And, the thing about commercial lending that if they're not in the commercial space, they may not be aware of is, there's a general rule of thumb in the United States, we're not doing fully amortizing loans. Those are 3, 5, sometimes 7, but 3 and 5 year balloon notes that are coming due. And, they'll do a 20-year amortization on those, but they're going to be calling those notes in 3 to 5 years. So you got two options. Well, three, I guess. You can either refinance it, which is going to be much more expensive to refinance it. You can sell it, which you may not be able to get as much money out of it as you thought you were able to get out of it before, or you can pay it off, and you're going to have to raise a lot more capital to be able to do that. So you kind of have that as the perfect storm as a backstop for some of these deals. And, there's an X factor that a lot of people aren't as familiar about. You can pay to have a rate cap oftentimes when you're financing these deals. And, a guy I was talking to told me that 3, 4 years ago, there was a group that paid $90,000 for a rate cap, did the same deal. It's a $20 million note. And they wanted $1.5 million for that rate cap. And so that's a huge swing. The question is, how confident are you in rates? How much is your risk tolerance? And so there's all these different factors, and it's created this capital markets turmoil that is why I say there is so much opportunity that has really just started and I think is going to continue to flow through the system for the foreseeable short-term future.
Just to remind everybody, if you are interested in what Grant is talking about, definitely check out his website. Head over to whiteboxrealestate.com. If you like what we're talking about so far, do us a quick favor, share it with one of your investor friends. And if you're watching us on YouTube, make sure you like and subscribe. So Grant, I'd be curious then, based on all of that, how has your underwriting changed during this time? Like it's gotta have been quite the exercise.
Yeah. The risk premium gets passed through, if you will. If you were looking at an exit of a 5 cap, you're going, man, with a really good credit tenant, maybe I get out of here with a 6.5. And that has reduced the yields. And so you have to be much more conservative on that. The other thing is, it really means that you have to look at much lower leverage, which obviously reduces your returns. But I just don't know if I could sleep at night having real, real high leverage, because it's commercial real estate. It's always tough. I mean, the thing is, it's different than what my experience has been with residential. And I don't trade residential properties, but from what I know, owning a house and selling a house and buying other houses, the especially, you know, I'm in Texas. Texas is home to some of the most overly exuberant developers in the 1980s. And, you know, there's a very famous developer, John Ulick, that used to say, his quote was, "A dollar borrowed is a dollar earned." And there's a great story about him defaulting on all these loans in the 1980s, because in the state of Texas, almost every single bank failed, all the SNLs failed, and you know, they had non-recourse loans on a lot of those, which, you know, you are seeing recourse on this stuff, and that's what makes everybody nervous, and that's the reason you're just not seeing the development that we've seen. But he goes in with a big key ring, and he's got a full boardroom with lenders, and he starts calling off addresses, and the guy would raise his hand, and he'd go, "Here you go," and he'd throw the key at him, and then he'd throw the key at the next one, he'd throw the key at the next one. And it really, you know, there's a lot of people that don't want to look into that loaded gun with personal guarantees, with, you know, loans that are going to be called. And so it really, you have to figure out how to make money with lower leverage or no leverage if you can. And I think that on the backside, what people have to remember, that's why it's so important to buy in good locations. If you buy in a good location, you know, that's the three most important things about real estate, which we talked about earlier. If you buy in a good location, you have that stability there because the demand is there, the users are going to be there, the buyers are going to be there. It maintains its value. And if you have that low leverage, that's one that you can lease up or raise the rents on. You can sell, you can refinance. If you don't have debt on it, you can put debt on it later when it's cheaper and refi your money out of it. There's a lot of different options, but it really comes into how risky you're wanting to be on the entry. And I really think that from an underwriting standpoint, that's what the change has been, is that people don't feel comfortable with that risky underwriting on the front end.
Would you mind painting a quick picture for us? Can you give us an example of something that you're currently working on, or some opportunity you just recently closed on, and what your expectations for it?
Sure. So I'm looking at a deal right now with a good client of mine, and it is in a core central location that's kind of a crossover hybrid type use, so I can attract more users. It is a building that went into financial distress, and you know, you're always, you know, it's one of those that sometimes they just need to get their money out of it, because, and we saw this like in 2008 a lot. You saw a lot of deferred maintenance, or they would start a capital improvement project and then things would shift and they wouldn't be able to finish the capital improvement project. And so those are real buy opportunities where you can go and, you know, buy it at a value that, for instance, a user couldn't do because they don't necessarily have the know-how. You know, some of that comes down to, let's say that there's a capital improvement project that has to be finished. Well, you got to know the vendors. You got to know the pricing. And, you know, just because of the volume, we're going to see a little bit different pricing metric than we see with, you know, if you're somebody that's just coming in off the street. And so we can realize and recognize that value and then buy those assets, finish those capital improvement projects. You know, we know the market, we're familiar with the market, we're comfortable with the market. We can put, you know, it's one of those that it works for a user, it works for a tenant. Either one works, either one will get us there. The other thing is, I know that we can get our money out of it because, you know, you're buying at a little bit of a discount just because you got to put work into it. And I know that the capital that we're putting into it is less than what the value of a building without the deferred maintenance would be. And so it's really playing upon those opportunistic events, and there's so many of them out there, and they're continuing to grow by the day. It's just trusting that those opportunities really are there. And that's where, you know, it, I tell everybody that real estate's nothing like the stock market, but it's also very much like the stock market because, you know, when you're buying commercial real estate, you have to treat it as a business deal. There's, you can't be emotional about a commercial property. You have to be completely unemotional. And when you get the price that you're looking for, and somebody wants to pay more for it than it's worth, sell, get rid of it. And you also have to realize, you know, commercial real estate, it's probably 30% math and fundamentals, and then it's about 70% art. And it's realizing the value that other people don't see in these particular properties and in these particular assets. And that takes time, it takes experience, but it's realizing where the opportunities are, realizing that, you know, you're going against the herd, because that's really what it comes down to, is when people are going left, I want to be trying to go right, because wherever the herd is going, you know, that's like buying GameStop or GameStop. You know, while when everybody's buying it, it's fine as long as it goes up. You just don't want to be the last one holding the hot potato. And that's what happens oftentimes with real estate, is a particular asset class, a particular location, whatever, is really, really, really hot. Everybody loves it. Everybody plows into it, and it's going up and up and up and up and up and up until somebody wakes up and says, you know what? I'm not sure I really like this. I'll give you a great example of that. There was a time that, you know, sale leasebacks, I mean, quite frankly, people didn't listen to us enough. You know, they said, well, I think if we wait a couple months, we'll be able to get an even lower cap rate, which would mean they'd make more money on the deal. And, you know, they kept compressing and compressing and compressing and compressing and compressing, primarily on the industrial side. And then one day, interest rates started going up, and they really started going up. And it crushed that market. It absolutely crushed that market. And, you know, everybody's reading the newspaper, but I really think that it's the right opportunity to start exploring some of those. If you're a user, start exploring some of those sale leasebacks, because there are buyers that are out there. You can, you know, you are going to see over the next 12 months, a pretty market increase, I think, for demand in certain markets. And, you know, you can take advantage of that. On the buy side, you need to be looking right now.
Well, you know, when we first started recording this, you mentioned that getting into this type of real estate investing has to be very deliberate. And you know, we've only covered the tip of the iceberg in the past 30 minutes here, but for those people that would be interested in this type of asset, what type of questions should they be asking somebody like you to make sure that they know what they're doing, that person knows what they're doing, and whether it's a good fit?
You know, I think a lot of it comes down, so much of what we do is trust. It's a trust thing. And if you don't feel good about the people that you're doing business with, then it's probably not a good deal. Obviously, I think that you need to make sure that they have the ability to perform. They do have access to the vendors that they're talking about. But the other thing is, you need to make sure that they have realistic expectations. And it's not a bad question to ask, if everything goes sideways, what happens? What are we left with? What do we look like? Because some of the deals that we see, that, you know, I talked about overly exuberant developers. A lot of these, boy, if everything goes right, it is an unbelievable return. But if there's any sort of hiccup, it throws a complete monkey wrench in the deal, and you're going to lose money on that deal. You really need to make sure that you have a professional or two that can advise as it relates to the market, can illustrate the value that's being created and how that flows through to the individual asset, and ultimately has the experience in that particular market. Because, I mean, I'll be the first one to tell you, if I'm doing deals in Atlanta, I'm going to call a buddy of mine to help advise me on what that looks like, because I wouldn't be able to tell you whether it's a good deal or it's a bad deal. And you really need to have somebody that you trust that can talk about that isn't just speculating, because a lot of the opportunities that you're going to be looking at are stuff isn't quite there. And what I mean by that is a lot of the opportunities that we look at, a lot of the opportunities that we target, a lot of the good opportunities that we like to pursue are ones that are undervalued today, but for a different reason are going to have a shift in dynamics. Great example. And I'm not looking at this particular deal, but I was talking to a group this morning and they said, well, what do you think about this market? And I said, you know, this market is a really good buy opportunity. And here's why. I said, it has grown out of favor as an office market. It just, nobody wants to lease space in this market, but it is growing in favor as a medical office market. And I said, you know, you have a hospital here, they're expanding this hospital, and this particular market is close. And if you look at the tenant base, it's a lot of hospital administration and so forth. And I said, this does have value. You're just kind of in that little phase where it hasn't quite gotten to that point. And so it's a little bit of a longer term hold, but there's a compelling reason as to why you're doing that. That's one that's really easy to see. I think what's hard, and we don't play a whole lot in that space, what's really hard is just going out to the middle of nowhere with true raw vacant land and saying, yeah, we're going to do something, we're going to develop here. That's really, really, really difficult. It's a lot easier to go to established markets, find some of these niche plays, because I'm also not competing with the institutions. You know, I'm in a huge market where the institutions are going to snipe all those big deals and they have the capital to do it. I'm playing in a space that's the sub-institutional space that is, you know, still in a it's like a high net worth players, family office players type arena. And that's the other thing is the capital involved in these, you know, you got to have some sort of diversification through a portfolio, through, you know, a diverse tenant base, whatever it is, that costs money. Leasing space costs money. Improvements cost money. Capital improvements cost money. Leasing commissions, attorney fees, all these things cost money. And that's where on the commercial side, we see a lot of people get into a bind is they don't understand the back end capital that's required. And they didn't underwrite the capital that's required in order to be able to finish the project.
And just to remind everybody, if you would like to learn a little bit more about what Grant is up to and how you can contact him, you can go over to whiteboxrealestate.com. Grant, you had a couple other options where people could get a hold of you as well, right?
Yeah, you can shoot us an email at contact@whiteboxrealestate.com, or you can call our main headquarters office in Dallas, 214-380-4540.
Well, Grant, this has been a great conversation. We kind of went down a couple rabbit holes here, but before we switch into the rapid fire questions and close out this episode, is there a question or concept you think we should have tried to cover here today?
Yeah, I think that the question or concept, and I'm glad that we don't have enough time for you to ask me about it, is what to do with Class B office product all around the United States. Because if you're an investor and you figure out what to do with that product type, you will make a fortune, because I don't think anybody knows what to do with it.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm sure, you know, our markets are very different, but I have seen so many buildings just sitting empty right now. Like, and I don't know if anybody knows what's going to happen with these things.
They're functionally obsolete. And if you figure out how to fix that, you will be a very wealthy man. And if anybody is listening to this, please let me know. We'll go in together on that one.
Well, Grant, if you're ready, we'll jump into the rapid fire. But again, it is whiteboxrealestate.com. The first question is, what lie do real estate investors tell themselves and sometimes to others?
The market will go up forever.
Yeah, that's a good one. Do you have a book recommendation, or what are you reading right now?
I am reading a book by Napoleon Hill right now. my book recommendation for anyone, I think would probably be Never Eat Alone.
I haven't, that's a new one. I'll have to check that one out. If you could go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
The advice that my mentor gave me my second year in the business. It's a marathon, not a sprint.
What single strategy, process, or tool have you implemented that has had the biggest time-saving impact to your business?
So I block schedule, and years ago I put together a not-to-do list. So, and that's in conjunction with, I try and quantify the value of what my time is, because I'm very methodical about everything that I do. If you look at your life as a math problem, you can back in, you know, what kind of money you need to make, and then mathematically speaking, figure out how many activities you have to do to get to that point. So you have to be really careful about your time, and you have to make sure that you're doing things that maximize the value of your time versus things that, you know, I started doing this before you could have virtual assistants and you had as much computing power as you have. There's so many tools that are out there, so many tricks that are out there to help you save time. The more time you can put back into your day, the better off you'll be.
A not-to-do list. I've never heard that. Could you give us a couple examples of what's on that list?
So, for instance, for setting up a tour, I would spend hours and hours and hours trying to track down people that had the listing on the building to set up a tour. And ultimately, I just needed to get into the space. So I had a wonderful executive assistant at the time, and I said, can you help me set up this tour? And she did. And it saved me probably 3 or 4 hours that I put back into my day. And so I was like, look, can you just do the next one? Can you do the next one? Can you do the next one? And now there's some systems and so forth to be able to do that. But, you know, it didn't really require calling the people to set it up, especially because if you really work in a particular market, you've probably seen that space or you've seen that building and you're familiar with it. So, yeah.
Well, Grant, this was a great conversation. I hope you'll come back again sometime, especially when you figure out what to do with that empty commercial space. Again, it is whiteboxrealestate.com. Definitely check out his website and for the contact information there, but really appreciate it, Grant. I hope
you'll chat thank you for having sometime. Me. Appreciate it.
Have you learned at least one actionable step to incorporate into your real estate investing? If so, please consider returning some of that value by leaving a positive review, subscribing to our YouTube channel, or joining our growing network on Facebook and Twitter. You can find links to all of our social media accounts in the show notes. See you next time.